I have the very pleasant duty, as always, of introducing the distinguished speaker this afternoon. Of course, Mr. Hiten Baiya is known to most people. He's after all a member of the Planning Commission. And I'm very grateful to him because he had a series of very important meetings. But he wrote me a rather nice letter saying that I may not be able to come, but these are the following suggestions I have in case I'm not able to come. But in any case, I'll not let you down. So I finally said, please don't let me down. Come at least for a day. So he's going to come and speak to you for equivalent to 2 lectures for this afternoon on the planning process. Well, purely for the sake of formality, I'll just say that he was chairman of the Indian Institute of Management, Calcutta. He was in Hindustan Steel. He was a member of the National Income and Wages Committee. He was on the Grindlay Bank. He's also received the Jaigir Gandhi Medal for Industrial Peace. Just the things that we want to know, how he managed all this. And as a member of the Planning Commission, I'm sure he'll have plenty to tell us this afternoon, because Planning Commission was also mentioned this morning in various ways. Sir, I do. The normal thing is that we allow you to speak and then have coffee and then discuss.
Sure.
But you can do as you wish.
Dr. Ramana and friends, it's true that I had committed to come here to Dr. Ramana. But in retrospect, I think it was just as well, but I don't think you could have stood me, or for that matter, any lecturer for 3 days. I think it's 1 day is just enough. But I was a bit demoralized this morning, and the first thing that Dr. Ramana told me, that you had a series of brilliant, stimulating, highly academic kind of lectures so far. So today, unfortunately, I have to bring you down to earth, to very humdrum things. And I'm sure this morning, Freddie must have generally hinted and made out that all the ills could be laid to the door of the government, who in their turn could lay it at the door of the Planning Commission, or planning itself. No, I am assuming that it should be so. But in any case, we shall have occasion to discuss that kind of thing, because apart from Freddie, I'm quite sure many of you have got similar worries in regard to planning and what planning has done to us. But I shall proceed. You have the slide one, please. I have planned to proceed from the concrete to the abstract.
Yes. No, okay, not that way. Not that way. No.
I decided to proceed from the concrete to the abstract because when we discuss various issues, they will be generalized issues, philosophical issues. But before we could do that, I thought it is necessary to know in detail the process itself, as to what goes on in planning, how it is done, what's its professional or objective base, before we could go on to the final discussions. So I planned my afternoon this way. The first two topics would be the planning process itself, and how the plans are formulated. That process itself is interesting and has got its limitations as well as its strength. The second is the planning methodology. As I was telling you, that after all, planning will need numbers. How are they generated? And is there some kind of objective base on which it is built, or is it just a kind of hunch and historical projections and things like that? So these two things, after I discuss these two things, which would be more conceptual and by way of information, the third topic, that is resource allocation. Yeah, I think you can see it all reading out. Resource allocation would, I'm afraid, involve some numbers. Of course, the numbers are purely by of illustration of the problem, but these numbers, some numbers will be rejected. And the fourth one, that is planning, implementation, policy and instruments, this is what you really see and you know about. So what is going on, what has happened and things like that. And I'm sure Satish Chandran must have covered development administration. Right, one aspect of it. So that is that part. I wouldn't waste too much time over it. Then the last three items, that is the experience, planning experience. I would quickly run down our experience from the first plan onwards, because that illustrates really what happened, how we muddled through from plan to plan, what are the new problems which came up, and the lessons that we can draw from it. And finally, the planning issues and the snags in planning, as I call them. Because I can see there are certain things which cannot be done ideally, and what are the handicaps in the way of planning. So actually, I feel that the last two items will really focus on to the discussions. The discussions will really come on to that. The other parts are merely information. So if you have any clarifications, you can ask it. So I thought we would like to get through the first three, if possible, by tea time. And you have a break after that. And then you go on through the others. Is that okay? Is the planning? Now, slide two, please. Later on, this can be pushed. If possible. Doesn't matter really. No, don't bother about it. I'll push it up because we'll go back soon. It's not important. Well, I didn't want totally to cut out the chairman, the prime minister, although we could probably gain time by that deputy chairman so that he can come on to the bottom. Now, the Planning Commission, I must say at the outset, is not a constitutional or a statutory body, as the Finance Commission is. The Planning Commission was set up purely by a fiat of the government, particularly Pandit Nehru, because he wanted it, he believed in planning, and he set it up. And the way it operates now is that it derives its sanctions really from the National Development Council, which consists of all the chief ministers of the states and the cabinet ministers of the center and the members of the Planning Commission, headed by the deputy chairman and the chairman, who is the prime minister himself. So this is the National Development Council which really endorses the plan and gives it any kind of sanctity. So over the years, this institution has come about, accepted, but there are problems in this area also, which I should mention later. Now, this round thing is the Planning Commission as it is constituted inside. That is, we have got people dealing with the state plans, we have people dealing with specific sectors like energy, agriculture, industry and so on, and we have got a whole lot of economists dealing with economic and overall perspective and analysis. This is really the composition of the Planning Commission in terms of its organization and disciplines. The National Development Council, the wisdom, is supposed to clear the objectives and goals for a particular plan period, which are set out in an approach paper. I'll mention that cycle to you. Now, you see this process, you see this M1, M2, M3. And these really are some of the external things which are considered separately. That is, here there's a question of population growth, exports, imports, which are not really necessarily amenable to planning as such, but have an impact on planning. So these are taken separately, projected, studied as an input. Then we have got what is known as autonomous investment. These are the economist terms. I'm not an economist. incidentally. In other words, certain investments, projects, number of projects posed by the ministries and departments, which have been there and not necessarily as a part of the plan investment, but have been there also as matters of exigency, certain projects have to be included in the plan. Now this kind of thing comes in, and there are two-way discussions continuously. It's an iterative process to which some kind of agreement is reached on the number of projects and things which ought to be done. And this M3 group, this group is really dealing with resources, financial resources, like foreign resources, public enterprise savings, borrowings, the budget for the center and so on. We will come to that very soon when we talk about resource allocation. Now here, this bulb here, this is where the Planning Commission's professional wisdom lies. And this is where there are several models and things which I'll explain in a minute, where the total economy is studied and projected in relation to any kind of growth pattern or any kind of objective that is demanded by the political rulers, or the economy as a whole. And this is really the professional and technical part, or the economic part of the planning, through which all these other kinds of things that are coming in are really harmonized to see that there is some internal consistency. Now similarly, on the other side, you find the state governments also, supposedly from the block level and the district level, their requirements, plans come in, and they are also projected through the Planning Commission, including their resources generation and so on. And we have this state planning meetings. And then finally, all these come through the full Planning Commission. See, this Planning Commission here has got permanent members like me, and but the full Planning Commission also has other ministers. And when you have a full Planning Commission meeting, the results of all this are discussed and final decisions on various situations are taken. And then this is again put back to the National Development Council, and when they endorse it finally, then it is placed before the Parliament. A draft outline is placed before the National Development Council, and after they've endorsed the plan, then it becomes an approved plan, which is put before the Parliament, and the Parliament usually endorses it. Now I will explain to you the actual mechanics of this. And you find this WGs, these are the working groups which are set up at the beginning of every plan, and even in annual plans. The working group consists of a bunch of experts, which includes ministry administrators, outside experts, various experts from all fields, and the Planning Commission people, who really go through the details of the various proposals, whether it's from the state side or from the ministry side and other things, so that they can come to some kind of size as to these are the items to be included, these are the kind of projects, this is the kind of requirement, this is the kind of investment needed, and so on. So this is the process as far as the public sector planning is concerned. But there is a whole lot of investment. Planning does not consist only in the public sector outlay, although that is what you hear. When you hear about a 180,000 crore plan, it means that is a public plan, the government's plan, the public sector plan. But the rest of the investment does take place in the private sector, and here it is only indicative kind of thing, which for which there has to be policy decisions and policy instruments to see that the kind of final investment pattern and final production that you want to see does take place. So this is in brief the composition and the process of planning. And the actual cycle is that an approach paper is prepared in the last year of the plan for the next plan. This is exactly what we are doing now. And that approach paper really sets down what we did achieve in the seventh plan, or what we did not achieve, and what ought to be done. What are the strategic approaches to be taken for the next plan to fulfill the kind of objectives that we perceive. And then this approach paper goes to the National Development Council, who approve of this. That means they approve of the approach, the strategies in various sectors, the overall strategy, the kind of growth to be attempted. And this, after this is done, then we do the detailed planning, for which we also set up the same process. That process you have already seen. And during the draft plan stage, really the detailed working is drawn. And this kind of working group is also set up in the last year of the plan. They have already been set up and they're working on it. The idea is that before the start of the next financial year, the plan year, that's 1st of April 1990, for instance, the entire process should be completed and the plan should be approved at least by the 31st of March. But very few plans have really worked to that kind of cycle, because one thing or the other has intervened. Because, for example, last year, the actual plan was approved in the end of 1985, after the first year of the plan was already on. That is because the government changed in 84 and so on. So this process of interaction continuously is the kind of process which characterizes our planning process in one single word. It's a consensus process. One is trying to achieve a consensus between the various center, the state, the ministries, the various sectors, and so on, to try to reach a compromise, including a compromise on political judgments of the parties in power. So planning is not merely an economic document, an economic plan, but it's also to some extent a political document. Because to some extent, many of the issues which relate to policy decisions do get changed, and there are compromises practically in every stage of this process. So that is why when you finally get a plan, it may not satisfy all kinds of logical arguments, because there has been compromise and give and take practically throughout the entire process. We have made some changes this year in this process, which I shall mention to you when I talk about the 8th plan. Now, may I go on to the next slide, please? This is the structure of the models, the mathematical models that are used in the Planning Commission. I told you in that bulb that there is a kind of working of the numbers inside the Planning Commission through the use of mathematical models. And this model, this is the structure of the 6th plan. And there was a core model. If you cannot read, I'll read out. There's an input-output model, an investment model, private consumption, import, employment, and so on. And there are some sub-models. Next slide, please. Now, this shows you how those models finally interact with the central input-output model and how they achieve internal consistency. And two things come out of this. One thing that comes out of this is a material balance. The input-output is in terms of value added in money terms, whereas something that comes out of this is also in physical terms. I won't go into the details of how this is done, but these are the various kinds of detailed working out of the models mathematically done, which are fed into these various things. Ultimately, an input-output model emerges. Now, this is really an internal instrument in the hands of the Planning Commission to see whether all these other kinds of projects and plans which are coming from the ground, from the states and other things, whether they fit into a pattern, whether they fit the ultimate kind of growth that we are thinking of, with the kind of priorities and weightages that we are thinking of, whether they do fit in or not. This is the independent judgment, this is the only independent judgment which the Planning Commission has. Not that this is very perfect, because I'll tell you also later on what the lacunae in this are. Next. Now, I told you about these various models, but each one of them have various constraints. Like, for instance, it may be demand constraint, maybe financial constraint, supply or capacity constraint, foreign exchange constraint, manpower constraint, and several other kinds of constraints. And these are the ones which are built in. This is called the economics of the model, as they prove it. There's a third part, that all these are ultimately made into equations. What I call the algebra of these models. There's an economics of the model, there's a major objective of the model, and there is this algebra of the model which makes it equation oriented. Therefore, it is computable. The whole idea of this is to compute and come to some numbers. And you cannot do this unless you have go through this kind of rigorous process. Now I come to the next one. I'll talk about the seventh plan. In the seventh plan, there's a slight change. We've got three core models and eight sub-models. And you'll be interested to know what they do. You don't need any details, but you're not interested to know what they do. The macroeconomic model, for instance, takes certain national income and expenditure identities and the basic things which you must be aware of on the resource side, like the income, national income, which is determined by the kind of growth rate, what's the kind of income that you want to achieve, and then what will be the consumption out of that income, what will be the savings out of that income, and what is the investment that you can make out of that that income. Now that kind of macroeconomic details are solved in this model. I will tell you very soon as to what are the kind of macroeconomic considerations which you are thinking of for the 8th plan. You must have seen the controversy about 5% growth, 6% growth, 7% growth. What it means in terms of actual working out, we'll do that. And that is done in that kind of model. Then we have the input-output model, which I told you about, and it's it started in 68-69 with about 225 matrix items, and these have been condensed, made up to date from time to time. We have got now 115 matrix, it is 115 items, which either go as inputs or come out as outputs, and they are interrelated. That's the kind of matrix which has been built through coefficients. And these are published data. You can see those things, those who are interested. And these are coefficients in value terms. But ultimately, out of that, it is also derived in terms of material balances. And this is done by first working out the kind of demands that will be generated in the various sectors for consumption, and then checking it with the supply side, and finally coming out with an input-output matrix, a table which will give us the kinds of inputs and kinds of outputs that you want in terms of the national income that you want to see. Finally, the third is, of course, the investment plan, investment model. You'll find there is another one called investment planning model also in the sub-model. The difference is, the first investment model, the large one, are really looking for sectoral consistencies. That if you invest so much in this sector, what is the effect on another sector and that kind of thing, so that there is a kind of matching between the sectoral investments in terms of the input-output model, in terms of the macroeconomic values that you have got. And then we come to the sub-models. These are of interest. I'll briefly mention, very briefly, as to what these do. The first one is demography and employment. A population projection on the basis of fertility rate, mortality, migration, and final addition to the labor force. These are tremendously important dimensions, and particularly for us, because that's one thing which really upsets all our plans. So this is what is done here, and from this, an employment requirement is also worked out. If certain number of labor force is being added, for example, the 40 million people are being added in the 8th plan, in the labor force group, that is 15 to 60 or 58, whatever the group is, then what is the kind of employment that you have to plan? For example, in the case of in the current plans, the last plan and this plan, we also have a direct employment program. So that kind of thing is worked out, how much do we need if possible. It is done very simple, as you know, in these programs, there is 50% labor, 50% material content. If the 50% labor content is divided by the wage rate, then you can easily get how many hours, man days, and so on. This is how it is derived. But, for example, in the 7th plan, we have worked out how much should be done through this direct plan, how much can come from the general development thing. This is the second model, really, the poverty model. This is something new which was added in the 7th plan because of the emphasis so much on poverty alleviation, poverty eradication in the long run. So one had to know as to how do you tackle this. What is the dimension of that poverty in terms of income distribution and the estimates of the people below the poverty line and things like that? And there, for instance, if you look at the 7th plan document, you'll find that 40 million man days are to be created through these direct employment programs. Another 22 million will come from the general developments. And that kind of overall dimensions to the planning are done, because poverty elimination has become one of the objectives. Similarly, you've got an agriculture thing. Now this is interesting because agriculture is one thing where land and water resources you cannot put in the input-output table, really speaking. It's not amenable to that kind of relationship. So ultimately you do use things like net zone area, irrigation, irrigated area, non-irrigated area, and if you have the use of fertilizer, if you have special programs, as you have in the 7th plan, for extending the agricultural potential in the eastern region, where there's plenty of water, but all the green revolution has taken place only in the western part of the country, northwestern part of the country, so this has to be extended now. If that becomes an objective, then that goes into the agricultural model to see what are the additional inputs, how much you will get from additional irrigation, how much you will get from other kinds of things. And from that is derived the food grains to be done, the other crops, what will be the cropping pattern and so on. That comes out as detailed objectives from this model. Then we get this industry model. This is of the same structure as last year. This really derives from the make mix, from the material balance that comes. And when you took the perspective plan also, the material balance of the country needs so much of iron, cement, or whatever you have. Particularly in detail, what is done is the intermediate goods, because that is the major thing. Then the infrastructural requirements like energy and so on, these are worked out. And then we get an industry model which gives actually the final produced goods, the intermediate goods that are required in numbers. The financial resources, it is to be linked to the macroeconomic model we are talking about. Because here what is done, it is done in much more detail, like savings takes place in the household sector, in the private corporate sector, in cooperative sector, it takes place in the public sector enterprises, the government itself, and so on. So all these are done, and the real object, what is done here is that the base scene is taken, and various scenarios are churned so that you know what is the kind of savings that are needed and where it will take place, what is the possibility and so on, so that the financial resources have to be planned in that way. Of course, whether the economy will exactly behave that way or not is a different thing. But one has to see in 5-year sense what's the possibility. Then we come to the export-import model. And this is a difficult model because export is really done in a kind of econometric analysis, the time series, the world trade trend and that kind of thing. It is really exogenous kind of thing. One doesn't really predict it very well. And in any case, whatever export requirement we have projected so far has not materialized. But in any case, it is linked, because it is linked with a requirement of imports. And to meet the imports, we need to export, and that is how it comes in balance of payment problems. And import is easier, because import, we have this bulk commodities, about 20 commodities we know in bulk, which you get, like petroleum, edible oil. Sometime back it used to be food also. There are several items like that. And that can come straight from, there's a coefficient related to the kind of consumption pattern that we're going to get. And then the effect on the balance of payment and the different scenarios is really worked out in that kind of model. And that is very crucial. And that comes back and forth as a point of debate all the time. Then we have got the consumption model. Basically, what it tries to do is to get the demand for goods and services for private consumption, final consumption. And in this, particularly identified are the consumption baskets in the rural and urban area, and also particularly the people below the poverty line. Because that is something which has to be ensured that that is there. So the consumption basket has to be identified and projected over the next 5 years. Now, investment planning. This, again, goes into more detail with about, there are 11 major sectors, subsectors of the economy that are taken. And here are the requirements of investment in the private sector, in the public sector. In the public sector, for instance, you've got these intermediate goods like steel, then you've got energy and so on. So what's the kind of investment that is needed? And what has been the incremental capital output requirement in the past? What it will be in the future, whether there is any possibility of technological changes and so on. Now, this is the kind of thing that is done here. Now, the result of all these goes back into those three big core models, which interact amongst themselves and come to a balanced kind of answer. So, this is, this gives you actually the mechanics of how plan figures are derived. And in fact, one always wondered whether these plan figures of requirements and things, how are they related, how do they come? Now, these are generated in this manner. Now, eighth plan, we are making some changes as a result of the experience. The first major change is this working. And then that used to come to the planning commission. These were looked at by the different sectoral divisions. And then they gave their comments as to whether this is good or bad or what can be done or not. Then finally it came to the members, and then we sat together to confabulate what can be done. And this method was not very good, because every time the working groups, if we added all the working group figures, last seventh plan I remember we had just joined when it was being finalized, the total requirement itself was over 300,000 crores, if you added all the working group requirements. Because they were looking at the need only. They were not looking at the resources or what is possible. So this became the point of embarrassment, because the working group recommendations were taken by each of the ministries or the states and said, this is our requirement, you ought to have this, your working group has recommended. So we've changed that this time. What we are doing now is having these working groups, but we have a steering group, smaller groups, steering groups over a whole sector, presided over by a member of the Planning Commission itself. So that, and the working group chairman of the various sectors are members and others also. So that from time to time as the working group is working, You can give out the signals. That way, this is the order of resources which will be available. Determine your priorities in that fashion and work out the requirements. And the necessity for this has evolved because of the time process also. Because the other process really meant, what it meant was that the working groups gave up a list of, a shopping list as it were. And all that the Planning Commission did at the end when they saw the resources was a cut and paste job. And I don't think that is really planning. And that is what we ought to have changed, particularly when we had an independent tool with this model. But yet, the things were getting totally out of hand. And in fact, I was telling my working groups that my motto in these sectors is that cut your coat, not according to your cloth, I said cut your coat according to your trousers. Because, why I say that? Because suddenly trousers is a bare necessity. It's already there. You have to cover it. Your coat you may forget sometimes and do without. Because one of the characteristics of the planning thing I have seen is that 60%, almost 60% of a particular plan is already preempted by what is going on and invested in the previous plan. And this is a big handicap in the sense that you cannot really do new things with a very limited amount of the rest of the 40%. This is one change that you made. The next change or next addition that you have done is in the case of, I've added another model, next slide, 7 and 8. This is for the energy sector. And this is one of the contributions which I thought I'd leave with the Planning Commission for future, because this is a tool . This is upside down or right? One. You did not read all that. I'll explain this. That when I looked at the total energy sector, I found that it was necessary to have a longer term point. At least have 20-year perspective, because it took 7 to 8 years for a mine to develop or even a hydro electric power station to be set up, atomic energy in 10 to 12 years and so on. Plus all our natural resources, the primary resources were also limited. So unless we knew about the primary resources over a longer period, it was no use having kind of plan for 5 years only. The second thing was that we ought to take all the modes and forms of energy in use or available to us. We could not just look at one source of energy, namely power. All the other sources of energy have to be looked at, particularly commercial energy. We couldn't look at non-commercial energy at this stage. And thirdly, we have to take a systemic view, right from the point of exploration for the primary source, its exploitation, then sending it for conversion into energy products, and then finally conveying the energy product, whether it's a refinery, pipeline or power through the transmission line and so on to the final consumption point and the pattern of consumption itself. Now until this entire system was looked at and planned for, we would get mismatches as we had in the past. I mean, it was a thumb rule that so much 40% of hydro should be there, that's the only mix that is best for us. Then we had coal raised, but the railways could not move it, the power station was set up, the coal was not coming, that kind of mismatch used to take place. So we thought we ought to tackle this. And the only way to tackle this, because this meant a large, very large processing of data, collection of data, for example, in the coal mines, coal sector itself, we had to get the details of our 400 working mines, 40 coal fields, their geological characteristics, the kind of technology that is necessary and so on. The whole object of this accessible model is that we shall establish the long-range marginal cost of each source of energy and see what is the optimal mix given our constraints of the reserves and so on, what is the best strategy we have of meeting the demands 20 years hence and right through? Now this is what we have achieved. The next slide, please. And essentially these have got separate supply models for electricity, for oil, for gas and for coal, and all these are again combined into an optimizing model to see the best mix. And this gives you how we went about it, as to what are the steps that we took in developing this model. I need not go into this, but this took us about 2.5 years of hard work, and as a result of that, I'm expecting to formulate a national energy plan, because it all means that not only the kind of investments that you should make in coal or in gas or in other things, investments, plus it also means several other policy decisions. Where will you use gas, in fertilizer or in power? It also means that the energy pricing policy had to be changed. It also means several other changes in the way of working of the SEBs, between the central power stations, state power stations, the grid working, and several other things. So that can be a more or less a consistent long-term policy, which we've been lacking in this enormous area. And this is where the maximum investment takes place. 30% of the last plan was invested in energy alone, and this may continue to be so. So this is one of the other models which we have added onto the one of the sub-models. The other two kinds of changes that you're making, agriculture, for instance, we talked to you about difficulties. Now what is being attempted now is that we are setting up studies in every agroclimatic zone. There's no use doing it in state-wise basis, because the resources and the utilization is on agroclimatic basis. There are 19 zones, and detailed cropping, resource, and other kind of thing is being done for each of the zones. Now that will be ultimately, the agricultural model should take note of that, possibly in the 9th plan, or maybe in the 8th plan itself, to do that. Now industry, of course, in the model there's not much of change, but the approach is changing in the sense that we can see, because of lack of resources, there will be less and less investment by the government in the industry sector. And it need not be now, because after these 20, 30 years, there's enough capacity build up, expertise build up in the private sector to take care of many of the things. Now, if that happens, then one has to also ensure that the production of goods is taking place in a manner which is consistent with our goals that you have set up. For example, we want wage goods to be produced. If we leave it entirely to the market forces, well, they need not produce those things, because they may not be very remunerative, the returns may be low. So there has to be this is, although this is indicative plan, one has to have policy instruments to see that the investments do take place in those areas, whether additional incentives or whatever kind of changes are needed in order for the investment to flow into the industries that you want them to flow. Now this is the kind of change that is taking place and will take place. This completes the first two portions of the planning process and the methodology that is behind this planning process. It has developed over several years. And when I talk to you about the planning experience, I'll be able to point out as to what are the points on which these kind of methodologies were introduced because of a felt need. Just as I told you that I have introduced this energy modeling at this point, because I thought this was something which ought to be done now, and it was possible to be done. Now I shall go on to the third topic, the resource allocation. Unless at this point of time you want any clarification on the first two, we can spend 10 minutes on that.
There are two minor points. When you showed us the first slide, you said you put population and exports together.
No, not together, separate.
I'm side by side on the same line.
Those are external kind of issues.
So they are external and not only emanating for planning. Because on export, export is ever conscious.
Policies, yes. But no numbers in the sense of input-output kind of thing. You set up an industry, it goes there. It's not amenable in that sense. Export is dependable on so many other things. But as I told you, you have got export-import sub-model. It is a separate sub-model. That was the sixth plan model that I showed you when they thought that was external. We have changed that into the seventh plan. But the export-import model, as I mentioned to you, is not exactly the same kind of thing as the other models.
The other thing, and you also said that there is a consensus process, the whole planning process is
yeah.
A consensus process. But while the details of where this plan and how much marginal changes could be considered, in the basic philosophy of consensus process, and the basic philosophy of
This I have kept as in one of the snag issues. I have kept this, we'll discuss it then. But I'll tell you this, so far, particularly up to the fifth plan, I would say, there has been a great deal of consensus on the plan. And even now, the consensus on the objectives is there. But the real issues that come up are regarding center state, resource allocation, etc. I'll mention those things later. But I will flag that point, and that's why I'm going into the resource allocation issue. It is on that it breaks down. There is no breaking down on the major goals. There is in the sense that some states representing a different kind of ideological approach, they do want a departure from many of the policy angles, not with the goals or the numbers, but with the policy angles. And that sort of thing is discussed at the National Development Council. And ultimately it is a consensus, no voting takes place, but there is a consensus in the sense that the minority, this kind of radical different approach, that is still a minority approach. And they do accept finally whilst voicing these criticisms. There is no split on that issue. But I will dilate on that as when you discuss the snags in planning. This is one of the major things I have identified, that how the consensus process is breaking down and ruffled.
Sir, you mentioned that something like 50% of
every plan gets preempted earlier.
Yeah. Well, would that, and I presume, you know, the 4-5 land is 40% or something like that. Would that mean that today, from the planning commission's point of view, that major directional changes will not be possible because they've already committed on account of, perhaps, if I may use the word, liabilities created by the previous plan?
Right.
That we're somewhat stuck in terms of what
correct.
We can do, and what is the planning commission over the next 10 years will be trying.
No, I'll tell you why, how I view it. This very large preemption of funds really happens because of the slow and tardy implementation of many of the projects. It's basically that is where the major fund money goes. And if a project, instead of completion in 5 years, drags on to 10 years, then it becomes a drag on the plan. So the answer really is that the more we can make plans within our capability, and we see that these are completed, finished within the plan period, to that extent the slate will be cleaner to have new directional changes in the areas that you want. But at the moment, that is a handicap. Now, I'll tell you, for instance, what I did in the sectors that I look after, energy, railways, for instance. Energy, when I looked at it, I found that new capacities were being added every year, and they're dragging on and on and on, and the portfolio is so large. So I said, let my strategy be to not to deny you funds at all for every ongoing scheme which is going to give benefit during the seventh plan. I did that, and with the result, this is the first plan where you will practically get installed the same capacity which was planned, almost there. But this created another difficulty. In energy planning, for instance, power planning, you have to start something now. It takes 3 years for the next plan, early years of the next plan. Now I didn't have money for that. And those were posed for external assistance, and external assistance has its problems. With the result that they are all delayed. To that extent, I'll be preempting those 8 plan power projects. And to that extent, my ability to start really large way for the 9th plan gets constricted. So I would say that this preemption is really coming from non-completion of projects. It's our implementational weaknesses that is creating this. Or taking on too much, which we cannot complete in the planned period to start. And this tendency is tremendous. There's pressure for starting new plants, new projects is very, very great. Railways, the same thing. I found the railways had a portfolio of new lines which are demanded for various reasons, but largely political demands. My region, there must be a rail link. I haven't got a rail link. In some cases, justified. They're not linked at all. But nevertheless, they had a portfolio of new rails like this, which would take them 2,000 crores to complete those. So we, on the other hand, we found that the railway system, and this is true of most of the infrastructure, over the years, they had not invested anything in replacing their overaged assets. They had not replaced their railway line. Fractures of railway line was taking place tremendously, so there's no use. Speed could not be done if there are so many fractures happening on the track. Electrification was not completed. Wagons were not replaced. Coaches, locos, these are becoming overaged, but then no new stocks were coming on. They were putting more and more on the new lines and things like that. So we decided on a policy that, all right, we looked at the need for overaged assets renewal. I found that it is impossible to do it in one plan. So we said we'll do this much in this plan. By the 8th plan, we'll liquidate the backlog of replacements. And you start on that. As a result, there are many other things we had to cut down. For example, one of the results of that conclusion was we found the railways over the years, early years, they were making their own coaches, wagons, this, that, and the other. So we say that there's no need for you to invest money in this. There is enough capacity built up in the public and the private sector for wagon building, for other things. They can even make locos. So why don't you offload? Now, we were not very successful in doing that because those things are already there, and some political decisions that take place which distort planning. For example, the Kaputthala coach factory was announced because of the Punjab Accord. So political decision. To that extent, in spite of the railways are telling that you shall not make any more coaches, you concentrate on operating your lines. So over the years, we'll be able to do that. So that is the kind of preemption that takes place.
How does accountability come at the implementation stage in terms of, because after the planning commission is a central
body? I have kept that implementation as a separate topic. We'll come to that.
Sir, may I make a clarification? Mention was made that in the 8th plan, one of the ideas under consideration for a change was to replace the present working group with the steering group.
No.
In addition.
You have an addition of the steering group.
The working groups will work under the direction of the steering group.
How will it really help in final decision making? Because, if I heard you correctly, the working group is really looking at a series of projects, maybe a collection of projects, demands coming from all over. Now, the fact that the steering group, presented by a planning commission member, they'll be going into it. But they'll be really having the wherewithal and the time and everything.
Oh yes, from time to time. For example, take now the power planning. Since we have done this modeling, our lines and priorities are very clear. So they don't have to do anything except identify the projects which can be completed, what are the kinds of things to be done. And they don't have to de novo work out the demand, which the working group used to do in every sector. They don't have to work out the demand has been projected by us. Then they don't have to find out what it should be the proportion between gas and hydro and thermal and nuclear. These things we have already worked out. Then the other kind of direction that we should give is that this is the likely resources available. So please indicate the priorities from the point of view of completion. In other words, we'll make the task of the working group lighter and not starting from first principles to do the entire demand projection, need projection, everything themselves. Now that itself took time, and in the second place it used to extend. It became totally need-based. We want to change them to resource-based kind of thinking. That's the major change. Roughly the size, the parameter within which they have to work.
Two small questions. When you are making a plan, obviously you are aiming at something, and there will be several items or objectives of the plan. Is there a hierarchy? Can you tell us what is the primary or the most important objective of the plan?
We'll come to that later, because later I'll come when I talk about the snags of planning. In regard to the broad objectives, I don't think the objectives will change very much until our major problems are solved, which is large, very large underdevelopment, very large
poverty.
No, the hierarchy comes in the question of strategy. The strategy really is to how much emphasis we'll place on this or that. And this, I will take up this point when I give you the plan experience as to what happened in the first plan, second plan, third plan, how the objectives, new objectives have emerged. The objectives are in the same list practically, but some objectives are getting more and more emphasis and priority.
My question is a little more directly, I was getting to something. I can see two, almost sometimes parallel, sometimes conflicting objectives. One is a certain minimum economic development growth of 5%, 6%, 7%, whatever it is. And the other is to ensure that the number or the percentage below the poverty line becomes less and less.
Right.
The two need not necessarily meet.
In my topic 5, which is planning issues, this is the first item. Growth and equity. I don't think this controversy will ever be solved, but I'll tell you the kind of dilemmas we have in that.
So the second point was that the plan really is a project with various schemes, and the amount of variables we have will be running into thousands of thousands, and the chances that everything will work the way it is planned is nil, if not. I mean, I will not even say remote, there's nil that everything will work the way it is planned. Now, in any such project that anyone undertakes, there has to be some amount of sensitivity analysis that what are the first 2, 5, 20 or 100 parameters which are most sensitive, where any slight change in those parameters will widely cause swing in the overall approach.
Yes, this is there. As I told you, as far as the macroeconomic issues are concerned, there is a sensitivity analysis and alternate scenarios. There we know. The macro ones we know. As far as the micro things are concerned, except for projects per se, individual projects, one doesn't work out that kind of thing. And that is why what I did not say complete it, but after this plan is done, the five-year plan is only an indication. The real planning is done every year because the actual budgetary resources are available only then. So when you go through the annual plan exercise, then we know the snags and the correctives and things. And a lot of distortion takes place. So the next stage that we do is that in the middle of the plan, we do the midterm appraisal. On the third year of the plan, there's a midterm appraisal, and we do apply correctives. If you look at the seventh plan midterm appraisal, you'll find many of the things we said that has not gone according to this because of these reasons. Basic thing, as you know, because of the drought, agriculture itself was out of gear. So certain things had to be done to push up agriculture. We had to cut down other things, we had to reduce the target of other things. Now that kind of thing, that is really the actual planning takes place in the annual plan process. And within the year also we took two or three reviews to see what is going on. And that is where this kind of correction takes place.
May I suggest that we have coffee now and continue the questions later, or would you like to have all the questions out?
On the first two, because the resource allocation is really more interesting and it involves numbers. We can come to that, we can have coffee.
Rest your throat off.
Yeah, okay.
We should have coffee now. And
okay. Come to the more interesting and part of the whole process, which leads to a number of problems which you see in the ground. Many of the questions that you raise are related to this, really. Now, first of all, I'll start with the overall resource calculation. And can you put that? Yeah, sometimes the Planning Commission doesn't know if it's coming or going. I would like you to, this we'll come back to this later, but I'd like you only to look at the bottom line. And you will notice that the sixth plan was stated in nominal terms for 97,500 crores at the 8081 price level. Actual expenditure when it ended at about 110,000 crores. That is because of the price rise and so on. And the seventh plan outlay is 180,000. Now this is about nearly double or 84% of the 97,500, an increase of about 84,000. If you relate it to the actual expenditure, that is the terminal year 84-85, then it is an increase of about 64%. Now, one can, even without going into all this kind of thing that the economists will work out, I always use the thumb rule that one can see if that has, and this has been the trend practically for many plans, then one can see that if this 180,000 crore plan, seventh plan, will probably end somewhere 215,000 in current terms. Now if it does that, and you apply these two figures, then you come to a public sector outlay of about around 350,000 crores. Now if you take the total kitty that was envisaged for the seventh plan, that was about 320,000 crores or thereabouts, out of which public sector was 180,000, which is say about 56% or so. If you have the same proportion, then the overall savings that you will need, overall kitty that you will need, will be of the order of 620,000 crores or 650,000 crores. Now that is the kind of thing that you need probably to have the same pattern of inflation, same pattern of distribution between public and private sector and so on, if you take that. Those are the orders of magnitude. Now, the major task, which when we are talking about the 5% growth and 6% growth, now this was the major issue that was being discussed. And the economists told us that, look, let us look at the macroeconomic parameters which determine all this kind of thing. And these are really the savings, final savings that you get, the kind of capital output ratio, that's the utilization of the investment that you make, the kind of imports that you need to maintain that kind of growth, the export that you need so that you don't have a balance of payment problem, and the amount of inflow of capital from outside that you have been getting or you want to get. Let us see, look at this. And on the board here, I have given you some of those preliminary kind of figures which were thrown out. Light, please. Now, this is a growth rate of 6%. I'm not counting 5% because nobody would look at 5% and say, well, we must go on a higher growth rate. 6%, and this is 7%. This up to this point, these are all savings figure, because that is the main thing which determines whether it will be that 620,000 I'm talking about or not. And this was, this is the savings rate in at the terminal year, expected terminal year in 89-90. It is not as high, you know, it's projected in the 7th plan that it should be 23, 24.5 or something. It has not happened like that. So this is where we are starting from. Now, for a 6% growth rate, not going into the mathematics of it, but there I told you that's the kind of figure one has in mind, then you need a savings rate in the terminal year of 26.87, that is in 94-95. And another, if you go for 7%, this becomes 33. So, this is the average, of course, over the 5 years, 25-28.6. Now the question of debate that arises is, will the, has the economy the capability or the trend to have that kind of savings? Because the savings, I didn't go into it, most of you are familiar with it, that in our economy the basic saving is taking place in the household sector. And the private corporate saving has been more or less stagnant, 3-4% or something like that. And within the public sector, the public enterprise saving has slightly improved, but the government side, the public administration, has become dis-saving, is minus. But that has been the pattern. So in that pattern, one wanted to judge. This is where the judgment question comes in. This is where the economic experts and others come in. So they say that if this rate of saving is not so important as to what happens at the margin. That means when the extra income, out of every extra income, how much do you want him to save? And it comes in the case of this kind of growth at 42, whereas if you had this, then it comes to 61.8. So one said that this does not seem possible. So one settled for that. All right, this may be possible. If this is possible, it means, of course, there are hundreds of policy instruments are necessary to see that that kind of saving takes place. That's the whole area, this is Freddie's area actually, that how all this can happen. But nevertheless, one did that. But when one did that, one said, all right, this will ensure you the investable savings. But will you get 6% rise in national income out of that? So then the question came on this. The incremental capital output ratio, that is, for each additional unit of income, how much capital you need. And the current figure is running at 4.6 or something like that. So they said that, well, you must bring it down to 4.4, and if you want 7%, must go down first. Now, here, when this was being argued, there were also the question of government dis-saving, that was being argued. Then the administrators, were representing the administrators in the commission, they said, because I'll go into that a little later, because what was said is that the government spending at the moment is about 12.5% of the GDP. And the economist said that if you want this kind of thing, the government saving must not go beyond 13%. 12.89 or something. It must not go beyond that. To which the administrator said that, look, don't be unrealistic. How can the government expenditure go down? It has never gone down. It will never go down. Government will go on merrily on that path. It can never go down. So you better not look for anything more from the government side. So you better increase your savings. I told the economist group, why don't you see the savings have increased? The economist came out with this, that look, if that happens, this is not going to happen. This is the maximum that you can do. So then if the arithmetic did not work, they said that look, this is the unknown figure. Let us reduce it so that you will get the 6% income. Now, there is the real issue. Particularly as far as you and I are concerned, because I also have been an executive and a manager, not an economist. My point about ICO is this, that this does not depend on any kind of economic instrument necessarily. It involves technology, it involves management, it involves motivation. Not merely industry sector, everywhere. Railways, post, energy, power stations, everywhere you have to have that kind of thing. And that is an unknown in which so far we have never done very well. Except there have been pockets of excellence here and there, but generally that is the weakness of our economy. But nevertheless, if given the thrust, given the will, and given this message that otherwise we can't get this kind of thing, so this is what is being coming out. And now it turns out some new arithmetic which is working out, which shows the government is saving will not probably come down. Now this is being suggested that even for 6% you have to go somewhere there, you have to reduce the ICOR. Then the other thing was that if you want to keep up this kind of growth, then in order, and you are also talking of international competitiveness, modernization, new technologies and so on and so forth, plus all the other kinds of imports which we need, right? So edible oil we shall need for a long time, basically petroleum and hydrocarbons will always be net importers. Now given that kind of thing, you have to determine your import. So the import should not be allowed to grow more than 10.8% of the GDP, and in this case you'll need even more. Higher growth rate means higher import coefficient. So that was there. This is one of the things derived from this. And now if you don't want to run into a balance of payment problem, then you have to do an export of that order. This is the kind of export growth that is necessary. Now this is also a question mark. This is a question mark. This is a question mark. This is a question mark. And then there is a question of net external inflow. That is foreign credit or foreign equity or remittances from abroad, any of those things. Now, normally India has been managing and has been fairly conservative, that net external inflow has not been more than 1 to 2% or 1.5% of the GDP, and we wanted to keep it that way. There is also a question of debate and argument. Many people feel that we could do with more external borrowing and we could increase the net capital outflow from abroad. But then there is a question of how much can you repay? What is your repayment capability that is connected with your export also? So the repayment capability, the debt servicing ability internally, and the same problem, when we come to this, will come to internal borrowing also. So whether one should have a risk taking in that area or not, these are the debatable issues. So when you ask the question that when you do the plan, but will it come out all right? In the plan, in every plan, there has been assumptions like this, based on this. In many cases, some of the assumptions haven't come true. In the case of 7th plan also, many of the assumptions, like savings, have not come true. I'll show you immediately what has happened in the 7th plan. So that kind of projection, that kind of risk, that kind of calculated judgment is necessary in case of planning. And through a process of debate, discussions inside the Planning Commission, outside the Planning Commission, one arrives at a consensus. But it also means, in many cases, and as in this case, as I said, after all it's a political document, it also means the commitment of the political ruling parties to a goal. And in this particular case, there was a very strong desire by the government that we should go in for a higher growth path, because all of us agreed that the indications were that the economy is certainly moving on a higher growth path. We have got out of that rut, and the resilience with which we went over this drought period shows that the consistent better growth rate in industry showed that. So one is really taking a calculated risk in trying for a 6% growth. But this is the kind of assumptions, they are not the exact numbers. But this is the kind of, to illustrate, I said that this is the kind of numbers on which the macroeconomic basis is determined.
Sir, do we have these leaders for the immediate past? This is forecast for the future. To get 6% growth rate, we are saying this should be the leaders.
Yeah, based on today's trends.
Do we have the present leaders on what has happened in the immediate past?
I'll show you a little bit of that later. But let me carry on with this. But having done this, as I said right in the beginning, as far as the private sector investment is concerned, this is left to the general process of the financial institutions, capital market, plus policy instruments. But the major concentration is on the public sector outlay. And for good reason, because if 50 or 60% or 55% of your total savings is going into the public sector, it's an important thing to look at. The second thing is that our economy has shown that it is quite sensitive to the investment that is made in the public sector. The rest of the economy is quite sensitive to that. Periods when this has gone down, the growth has also gone down. Thirdly, and this we'll discuss when we discuss the issue, why planning at all, that as long as we have got this other tremendous backlog of backwardness, poverty, numbers, etc. in the social sector, as long as we have got our infrastructure not yet built, half our resources not utilized, and roads are not there in 100,000 villages yet, this kind of thing, there will be need for public investment. So public sector investment, therefore, catches everybody's eye. And this is the basic task, the major task of the Planning Commission is really controlling the public sector outlay and plan. There, number 10. Here, before I keep that, I'll only ask you to remember two things. That this shows the allocation in the 6th plan and the 7th plan. And the division between the center and the states. You see, the original division of outlay was almost half and half between center and state. But in actually, when it finished the 6th plan, it was 53 and 44. So the 7th plan outlay starts with that kind of division between center and state. Now I'll come back to that later. Now, I should have put some other numbers, but I'll mention them. These actual numbers are not important, but it will show you how, when the 7th plan was formulated, this is the kind of picture of resources that was being given to us from time to time, every time recalculated. The interesting part in this, and that is where when you asked what is the current thing and what has happened, I will point out to the first figure. This is the balance from current revenues. That means you should normally have a surplus from your revenue expenditure to invest in development. But for the first time, what has happened in the 7th plan, right in the 7th plan, it may happen in the 8th plan too, that this part is showing negative. Now, what is probably happening in real things, we haven't got all the figures, that this figure probably the negative, it remains negative and probably up, and this also is probably on the whole will not be positive. Or even if it is positive, it will become less. In other words, the negative figure will be high. This negative is about 3% of the total. So you start with a 3% minus for your plan. But the major items that you see here are the contribution from public enterprises, which includes railway, post, telegraph, other enterprises, state enterprises. Now, interesting thing is the state electricity boards and the road transport corporations, which are the major public sector enterprises, these have a negative contribution. And this has something to do with the tariff, something to do with the management, efficiency, and so on and so forth. For example, in the state electricity boards, practically all states give